Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to a special edition of the Four Seams Fire American Soccer Show, the review show for last night's international friendly this past Friday at MetLife Stadium. The United States taking on Brazil, and the kids fall to a very well-experienced side by a final of 2-0. Most of the goals came in the first half. Early goal in the 11th minute, Roberto Firmino just puts in an easy ball served on a platter from Douglas Costa. And then, of course, a penalty kick converted by Neymar in the 43rd minute. That's probably one of the most dubious penalties I've ever seen. But, you know, we'll get to it in just a few minutes or so. But as we await Kartik Krishnayer from World Soccer Talk, let me just say this about these kids. This is only one game in this six-match fall series. First of six. Of course, they're going to take on Mexico this coming Tuesday in Nashville, Tennessee at Nissan Stadium. And then the United States will be hosting two more matches in the month of October, as they will be taking on a very, very big, big matchup, as they'll take on Colombia on October the 11th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time over at Raymond James Stadium in Tampa, Florida, which will be seen on Fox Sports 1. And then October 16th, just signed a big matchup against another South American nation that is going to be huge, and that they're on the rise at the moment. Of course, they finally get to their first World Cup in over 50 years, and that is, of course, Peru. So Peru will be over at Pratt & Whitney Stadium at Rentschler Field in East Hartford, Connecticut. Of course, Rentschler Field, the home of UConn's college football team. That will be on ESPN2, also at Tuesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And then the big travel matches, as they will face England on November 15th at 3 o'clock Eastern over at Wembley Stadium. Still a to-be-determined or to-be-announced matchup, or not so much the matchup, but to-be-announced where the match will be played, as the United States will take on Italy to round off the fall series of these matches. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, what we want to see here in these friendlies, how well the United States, with this young crop of talented Americans, how they do well taking on these major players in international football, how they go out there, how do they perform, how they try and, match themselves against. And at the same time, you know, are we going to see them lose their cool when they are playing against a team, let's be honest with ourselves here, Brazil is a world-class team. And if you watch the match, I was at MetLife Stadium at the Meadowlands in East Rutherford, New Jersey. You can easily see Brazil 2 to 3 steps ahead of the United States, 2 to 3 steps ahead of the kids that tried their best. Maybe a bit nervy in the first half, but you saw them working on it. You saw them attacking afterwards, finally earning some confidence, gaining some confidence in that first half, putting out there several opportunities to try and get shots on frame. And unfortunately for the United States, though, it all came to a crashing halt when the referee And it has to be said, the referee gave a very dubious penalty. Soft is not even the word. It was comical to see Fabinho falling down inside the area as soon as he got past John Brooks. John Brooks did not touch him. John Brooks did not do anything. And Will Trapp, I mean, that's not a grab at all. Will Trapp, maybe he leaned into him a little bit, trying to shield him away or try to shield him off the ball. But still, though, is that enough for a penalty to be called? Absolutely not. And unfortunately for the United States, the match was over in the 43rd minute. Even though, give credit to Weston McKennie, he fought like heck to get into perfect position to try and get into that position to score some goals. He tried his best. He tried his hardest. And unfortunately for Weston McKennie, since his first ever U.S. senior men's national team goal against Portugal in Portugal, he hasn't been able to score yet since that road match in the end of 2017. What does this mean for the United States right now? Well, once again, the kids can learn a lot playing in a match like this. It is not a shame to lose in a match like this against a powerful, well-managed, and at the same time, born in the womb with the football. And when they're ready to come out, they go ahead, put on their kits, lace up their boots, inflate the soccer balls, their footballs, inflate them, go to the local park, go into the local streets, and just go out and do what you got to do to try and become a professional footballer for a club, and the hope and praying that you'll make it as a member of the national team. I really believe that these kids are the future of the national team. Now, obviously, some of you are saying to yourselves, maybe we should bring back some veterans. Maybe some veterans should be coming in, and some veterans should be able to go out there and to make a difference. As of right now, you don't need to see a veteran out there. You don't need to see a Michael Bradley. You don't need to see a Jozy Altidore, even though you probably think to yourselves, well, you know what, why should we even bother having these guys in, you know, if they're going to prove to be a big failure towards the end of what happened at the end of 2017. Here is the thing that I have to say, is that it's refreshing to see a youthful side going out there and performing at the highest level. We don't know how many of them will remain on the national team in the future. One person I do know, and yes, I have seen him many, many times in front of me, is Tyler Adams. Tyler Adams is that important cog for the future of the U.S. men's national team. All I can say is that for the United States right now, they are on the right path to fixing what happened on that terrible night down in Trinidad and Tobago in November of 2017. The United States is on the right track to bring in these kids and let them show what they are made of. Let them show what they can do. Maybe a little bit more straight on the shots on frame. Maybe a little bit better. Maybe a little bit fast. A little bit more faster. But when you are able to play and think at a higher level, and Brazil showed why, that they are still one of the top nations in the world when it comes to football, all you can say is this, is that the day that our kids, get to that level and compete at that same level as Brazil does, this is going to be something special. This is going to be something special when you are going to see these kids go out there and absolutely kill it. Tim Weah, Tyler Adams, Julian Green. I think right now what we are seeing is the building of a brand new side. Some will probably be used as bench players. Some of them will be used as starters. I think for Zach Steffen, I thought he had a decent match in goal. I thought he did a decent job out there. Not his fault in the first goal. You know, you're young and enthusiastic. You want to try and prevent a penalty from going in, and it's against Neymar. And all Neymar really did was wait for Zach Steffen to make his move. And Neymar just said, okay, you can go to the left, I'll go to your right. And that's what he did, just deposited to the right side. And, you know, once again, the one of the greatest footballers in the world right now gets a penalty kick. And once again, a dubious penalty. A very, very dubious penalty. This situation right now. I wish the referee, I mean, obviously there's no video assistant referee, there's no video review, and I understand that. But once again, it's just unbelievable when you are seeing a penalty being called for a foul that is basically not a foul. And once again, sometimes referees, you're just going to have to understand that they will be helping out the veteran side in Brazil, because obviously the majority of the people in the stands were from Brazil. That's fine. But once again, it's a situation where, you know, this was a tough matchup. And all you can do is just go out there and you got to fight off 12 men. But the one thing I liked about this matchup, of course, you know, there were some hard fouls. And the referee did let them play on. And the referee, you know, the referee's going to do what the referee's going to do. There's nothing much more you can say or do about that. The referees will do whatever they want to do. So all I can say is on that part that it's just going to be very, very tough to try and climb back up on the scoreboard and try and do whatever you can to go out there, try and be as positive as you can be, get ready for a huge, huge matchup as, once again, this whole situation is very, very difficult when you are facing a very tough opponent in the likes of Brazil. These kids, so far, I think they have proven one thing. I think they've proven that they are not scared, that they have confidence in themselves. Granted, a little nervy to start the match. I mean, once again, you are facing a five-time World Cup champion in Brazil. But once it's all said and done and they finally were able to get themselves into the match, they found a way to go out there and continue to attack. And attack. I thought defensively outside of the first goal, because I'm not counting the penalty, obviously. Outside the first goal, I thought defensively they did a great job. I thought defensively they plugged in the holes where they had to. Obviously, Matt Miazga, very poor decision-making there. He peeled off, went to the near post. Instead, he should have gone to the far post because that's where the goal was scored. And that is where, for the United States, they were automatically down 1-0. Roberto Firmino, once again, getting a brilliant ball by Douglas Costa to whip it in there. And they found a way to get it in. And they played absolutely a brilliant ball on that one. But once again, outside of that one mistake, I thought the United States, I thought the kids did a very good job, and I feel like they're going to get better. Joining me right now, Kartik Krishnar from World Soccer Talk, as we recap this friendly. Kartik, you know, obviously you don't like to see the kids get scored on early, and, you know, every right to criticize Matt Miazga, why he peeled away from Firmino on that goal. But, I mean, since then, I thought he recovered very well. I thought Miazga was a very strong center back after the poor decision there. And he actually saves a goal in the second half because in the 52nd minute, Zach Steffen, he made a save, but not all the way, and it rolled behind him dangerously to the goal line, and Miazga's right there to clear it off the line.
Yeah, I mean, Daniel, good to be with you. I apologize. I have another call related to our sport business conference in Miami next week or week after next that ran over, so I apologize. Talking actually U.S. soccer, the U.S. soccer panel we're putting together, but details on that will be announced. A little teaser here for those of you listening. Will be probably announced Monday or Tuesday. I thought Miazga made a mistake. You know, the positioning sense Miazga has is still a work in progress, right? I don't think he's positionally sound the way Gucci Onyewu was in his prime, or Eddie Pope was, or Marcelo Balboa, the center backs, the great center backs we've had with the United States, and even the Demarais and Boca, when Boca would play center back, Boca Negra. His skill on the ball is really interesting to me, you know, as a ball-playing center half, and I think he's a good complement to John Brooks, who's, of course, a strong ball winner, and who showed a pretty good range of passing yesterday to John Brooks. So I was pleased with him. I felt like Miazga and Brooks is your pairing for the future. You know, I mentioned the other day that Timmy Reeves could again for Fulham. I think he's going to be back in that team. And if a guy's playing 90 minutes in Premier League, you're going to want to give him a run out with the United States. But I am aware of Timmy Reeves being 30 and that, you know, it is time to turn the page. But I think he can still help this team. I'm interested in seeing what Tim Parker brings in the game on and Aaron Long, right? Those two guys on Wednesday or Tuesday, excuse me, game's Tuesday against Mexico. I'm interested in seeing what those two guys can bring at the center half position. I think that center backs have been a concern for me. I also want to mention something real quickly before you ask me the next question. I think Will Trapp as a guy shielding the back four. I don't like seeing Tyler Adams put in a more advanced position. I think Tyler Adams is the guy that's dynamic enough to where you can play him in front of the back four, and then he has a range of passing and an ability to get up the pitch or push into wide areas that allows him to be mobile from that number six position. I don't think we saw quite that mobility with Trapp, and I think we also saw some positioning errors from Will Trapp, as good as he's been for Columbus this season. So, if there's one bone I have to pick with Sarakin's team sheet, well, there would be two bones. One would be Areola, but he just had a bad game, right? But the one bone tactically maybe to pick would be not playing Tyler Adams in his natural number six position. I know he can play anywhere. You know that better than anyone covering Red Bull. But maybe Trapp is a guy that you have to get going forward, but you play Tyler Adams naturally in the number six. You allow Ben Weston McKinney to play with a little more space in the center of midfield, and then when you have Christian Pulisic back, you make a decision on where you want to play him accordingly based on Adams playing as a six.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, look, Tyler Adams has been proven that, you know, he likes being in the midfield. Obviously, he doesn't want to go to – he doesn't want to become a striker. That's way too much for him. He admitted the one time over after a Red Bulls home match against an opponent at Red Bull Arena. But the truth is that Tyler Adams, I agree with you, Kardec, you know, he's your box-to-box midfielder. You know, he can play defense. He can be put up in a more advanced position, set up some chances, free kicks as well. He's starting to prove now that he is going to be a very dangerous player, a very dangerous defender, and a very dangerous attacker down in the future. As soon as he is done with this MLS season and goes with the Red Bull Leipzig in the German Bundesliga, I agree with most people. I think on the national team, not saying I don't want to see Tyler Adams advance into a more attacking role, but he can do it whenever, you know, he can see it himself. Meaning, like, stay defensive, watch what happens. If you want to pick your spots, do so, and then try and send a great ball to, you know, if Tim Weah is open, maybe he'll be with Jozy Altidore if he's open, who Christian Pulisic if he's open. That's when you need to make sure that Tyler Adams, and I'm not saying it up, pulling the reins or anything like that, because Tyler Adams is smart enough when to come back and track back into his position and prepare to be a defensive player once again.
Yeah, so I think that this is something that we have to work on going forward. I know there are a lot of people who seem to think that Trapp can play that role. Maybe Kellen Acosta can play that role. I'm more sold on Trapp than Acosta. Look, I'm not sure Kellen Acosta's quite developed the way we thought he would, like so many American players in the past that we've gotten excited about at 18 or 19. And just by the time he's 22 or 23, you're thinking, this isn't working out. And then I think you also have the potential, if you will, to play, you know, play potentially with a guy like a Marky Delgado, who we're going to see, I believe, in the next match. In a more withdrawn position, and I allow him to shield the back four. You know, another consideration going forward is when you get some of the guys that are injured back into this team, specifically a guy like Kenny Seitz, who can play out wide, and he's coming off an injury, right? No one wants to hear it, but I still think that Michael Bradley and Alejandro Bedoya can help this team, but I guess no one wants to talk about that. But if you were to bring one of those two guys back, you can drop Adams into a much more natural role. And I think in that, particularly let's talk about Bedoya. Bedoya, we're back in the team. Bedoya can hold up play. He can hold the ball. He makes intelligent runs to clear space for other midfielders. And look, Daniel, I have an axe to grind. I have a bone to pick. I'm really frustrated by the our fan base and their attitudes towards these two players, and I'm annoyed about their attitude towards Jozy Altidore too. But you know, the Bedoya and Bradley things, I just can't understand. I don't know what our fans have been watching the last 5 or 6 years that made them determine that these guys are not useful players. But so if you were able to bring Michael Bradley back into the team, and you were able to bring and you can play Bradley in a withdrawn role, then you can push Adams forward, or they can play off of one another. Or if you have Bedoya in the team and he starts wide and he cuts inside, you have the ability for him to hold the ball, hold up play, create space for Tyler Adams. The midfield we had yesterday with the likes of Kellen Acosta and you know, Roldan had come on, those guys, and Trapp, those guys just can't do that job. Nothing against them, but they are not players at the level of Michael Bradley or Alejandro Bedoya. Now, could they be someday? Maybe. But if I have the bet, if I were a betting man, I'd say none of those guys are going to be anywhere near as good as Michael Bradley or Alejandro Bedoya. So I'm annoyed by the attitude of some of our fans. I'm hoping whenever the permanent manager comes in, he takes a look at specifically three players again, Bedoya, Bradley, and Altidore. And quite frankly, I'm not sure anyone has made the case playing striker for the United States. I mean, keep in mind, Julian Green is playing in a wide position now. He's not an out-and-out striker. He played pretty well. He played well last night. But
no, he really did.
He's a wide – yeah, he's a wide player. And he played well. He played very well against France. Bobby Wood, Novakovic, the other guys we played up front have not made a compelling case that they should play ahead of Jozy Altidore, period. End of story. And you guys can tweet at me. You guys can get angry at me. That's my view until someone proves that they're better than Altidore at the striker position. Someone proves that they're better than Bradley at the number 8 or number 6 role. Someone proves they're better than Bedoya as kind of a utility midfielder. That's my attitude.
Well, here's my thing about Michael Bradley, and I think I've said this to you many, many times, Cardiff, because once again, I'm sick and tired of seeing Michael Bradley in a withdrawn role in the midfield. Because when you put Michael Bradley in a withdrawn role where he is all the way along with the back line, and I still contend if Michael Bradley comes back to the national team and if the whoever's going to be the next U.S. men's national team head coach and he says, I need you, Michael Bradley, to come in, this is what I believe needs to happen, and I will keep saying it till I'm blue in the face. Michael Bradley is not a withdrawn player in the midfield. He's not.
And now he might be able to play him in a more advanced role, whoever that next coach is. Because, Daniel, the point remains that when Jermaine Jones and Kyle Beckerman were in the U.S. team, Michael Bradley was able to play in a more advanced role. Jurgen Klinsmann had him playing in a more advanced role. And things were good. I mean, but the problem was Jones and Beckerman were both old, and there were no ready-made replacements for those two guys. Jones is now retired from professional soccer as of yesterday. We still don't have a guy at this level playing in that place. So what I think needs to happen is you play Tyler Adams there. I know the temptation is to play Tyler Adams further forward. You play Adams there. You drop Trapp. You play Bradley where Adams played yesterday. He plays off of McKinney. And then, you know, Areola, you drop and you bring Pulisic back there. I like what I've seen from Julian Green. Look, I've been skeptical of Green for many years. But what he's shown me in these last two friendlies is kind of an invention, a guile, and quite frankly, just like a level of hustle that has been lacking from a lot of our guys. So I say maybe Green's not your starter there, but you keep him around. I know he's had a terrible club career the last few seasons between Bayern and then Stuttgart and now Grüther Führer, but he Julian Green seems to be one of these guys that when he comes to the U.S. and plays for the national team, he plays well. So I keep him around. But I just think you got to get Michael Bradley back into the team. Every subsequent friendly that goes by and I watch and, you know, you get on Twitter and people are raving about this young player or that young player, okay, great. There's a lot of potential there. But I still see where it's an unfinished product and the holes that are in the side in midfield could be patched up if Michael Bradley is in midfield and isn't in the position he was in 2017 during the qualifiers where we had absolute rubbish midfielders around him and he had to do everything. You know, he had Darlington Nagby, who never tracked back, who takes too many touches on the ball, who is positionally kind of inept. We had Areola, who was, you know, at times was good, at times wasn't very good. We didn't have Beckerman at all in the cycle. We didn't have Jones at all in the cycle. I think now that you've got Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie, which we didn't have a year ago, Michael Bradley looks like a different player in that team with those two guys, okay? And I know we want to talk about the game. I didn't want to come on here and lobby for Michael Bradley, but it seems like all I have to do all the time because there's just so much dismissiveness and nastiness towards him, which, Daniel, I just can't understand it. I mean, how come our fans are so ungrateful to one of our great players in American history? I just don't get it.
Well, the truth of the matter is this, Cardick, is that, you know, Michael Bradley, along with Jozy Altidore, those were the two culprits. And I'm being honest here, Cardick. You know, I understand that Michael Bradley and Jozy Altidore, those are the two guys that made our national team tick along with Clint Dempsey. But the truth of the matter is this. Yeah, but the truth of the matter is this. When you have these two guys as your veterans for the national team, and they're supposed to be the ones that are pumping up the players to go out there, fight for every single blade of grass on the pitch. whether it's waterlogged or dry or maybe just a few spots here and there. To me, they are being vilified, and I will say this, rightfully so, until they find a way to get the forgiveness of the American soccer supporter, because they are the culprits of that major letdown that happened. Like we've said many, many times, when that magical night happened, Kardik, it wasn't just Klinsmann's fault. It was Bruce's fault. It was Josie's fault. It was Bradley's fault. And all of a sudden, every time they went on the road in MLS playing for Toronto, and every time they touched the ball, they got booed on the road, and deservedly so. And for some silly, stupid reason, their attitude was just not good enough.
Yeah, I think the leadership thing. I think that point, and agree with you. I mean, I don't think we had a vocal leader on this team. If there was any vocal leader, Tim Howard, and he was the goalkeeper. But you know, going forward, I think they can both still contribute to the national team, as does Alejandro Bedoya, in my opinion, can contribute. But you know, looking at the bigger picture after this match, I felt like what we saw from McKinney and Adams was particularly exciting, right? The way that those two guys linked
absolutely.
Up, and I think we also saw an ability to get guys into tight spaces in the area, and a little bit of creativity from the likes of McKinney when Timmy Weah came on, certainly from him. Julian Green wasn't necessarily creative, although he was actually. There was one great opportunity he created, but was very resourceful, I would say. You know, there is some concern, I think, about Paul Arriola. I'm not quite sure what the long-term view of him is in this pool, but he obviously showed at times in the last cycle that he is very good at tracking back and playing defensively, and has a little bit of an end product going forward.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there, absolutely. And, you know, going back to the whole, you know, is Bradley better as a 6? Is he better as a 9 or a 10? You know, being more an attacking role. When Tyler Adams, when he is in the number 6 on the pitch, I expect Bradley to be a number 10. I expect him to be a number 10, attacking with the ball, being creative with the ball, and making sure that he does not track back on defense. Only if the back line basically, I want Michael Bradley to pull a Wayne Rooney. That's what I want to see him do. You know, if there is no goalkeeper in the net and everyone is at the far side of the field trying to head in either an equalizer or a match winner. That's when I want to see Michael Bradley tracking back into a deep midfield role. That's the only time. Because once again, when Tyler Adams is going to get the nod as a number 6, that's when Michael Bradley is going to know, and he needs to know, you cannot be a defensive midfielder anymore. You cannot start from a deep midfield role, because what you have done, and this is why I disagreed with this all the time, you're basically getting rid of a defensive midfielder or a sweeper just so you can make Michael Bradley happy, and no, it cannot happen again.
I agree with that.
That's how I feel.
I think the question with Tyler Adams is, does he, if you play him deeper as a 6, I advocated it earlier in the show, but as we're talking about this, these are the possible critiques that Dave Sarokin could give us. Do you lose his ability to get forward and truly play box to box? Now you want your 6 to play box to box theoretically, but there is a holding responsibility if you're the 6 and you're not flanked by another holding midfielder. So, you know, this year at Chelsea, N'Golo Kante can get forward because Jorginho is sitting deeper. But typically that hasn't been the case, right, with Conte, with Manchester City. De Bruyne, he's injured, but when he comes back, he's able to get forward because Fernandinho sits in front of the back four. If Adams is that guy that's responsible for that, does he not get forward? Now, I think he might against CONCACAF opposition. What you really need, though, is perhaps a situation where DeAndre Yedlin is a little more disciplined in terms of when he goes forward. And same thing with Anthony Robinson, if he in fact, the left back going forward, which it appears he will be. Robinson is playing regularly at Wigan. He's played in all six matches in the championship this year. I just hope he can hold down a job in the championship. It's a tough league. We've seen American guys kind of fall out of favor there. So that's the big question tactically. And then obviously we've got a number of players that are not in this camp that could contribute going forward. And I mentioned one that is in this camp that we might see on Tuesday, in Marky Delgado, who I think is a pretty nice player. Now, there are some other guys that you could look at again. I mean, I think, though, that in general we're looking at kind of the core of the team going forward. Rubio Rubin is still 22 years old. He could get another couple looks. And Keaton Parks, obviously, is a player that a lot of people are excited about. And Kenny Saif has been injured. He just came back from injury. I think he played his first game in the Eredivisie in quite a while this past week. Sarakin opted not to call him in. And then there's some question about who the next coach will be, right, Daniel? I mean, we're seeing reports out there about who's being talked to, who's rumored, Greg Berhalter, others. I mean, I've gone on record saying I think Jesse Marsh should be the coach of this national team. But I have to say, if I'm Jesse Marsch and I'm at Red Bull Leipzig, or I'm at RB Leipzig, and I'm on that staff, I don't necessarily say yes unless I'm given certain latitude with my picks. So, Marsch may not be the guy. He may not be the best time for him to take this job. I mean, my preference would be if it were him, but if it's not him, I guess we heard Berhalter's name. I'm seeing reports of David Moyes. That would certainly be very interesting tactically. Moyes was pretty successful at Everton, and I think he knows. He's had a number of American players between his time at Preston when he had Eddie Lewis and Brian McBride, and then at Everton where he had Joe Max Moore. Well, I don't think he had Joe Max Moore, but he had Timmy Howard. He brought Anton Peterlin in for a bit there. Get Cody Arnault a look. Obviously, I had Landon Donovan. So, I mean, it'll be interesting if it's Moyes. And then who else has been mentioned? Peter Vermees. I don't like that idea. I don't think that's a good idea. So, I favor Marsch. I could live with Berhalter. I could live with Moyes. I don't like the idea of Vermees. I mean, if we want to get into it, we can. But I'll just say that. I think Vermees would be the wrong guy.
Well, let me ask you this, though. What would you say if, let's just say for the heck of it, Tata Martino, if he leaves Atlanta United and becomes the head coach of the U.S. men's national team? What do you think that could lead? Because I know some are saying, you got to talk to the American press in English. I've talked to a couple of people here and there. They think he knows more English than he leads on and stuff like that, so... I mean, I wouldn't mind having Tata Martino running the U.S. national team because I think he would definitely make a major improvement into the style of play right off the bat.
Yeah, I think that's pretty obvious. And this thing about him not knowing English, I think with Martino, what I understand is that he doesn't feel comfortable speaking English to the media. However, which you remember was the case with Mauricio Pochettino, who's also Argentine, when he was at Southampton. Mm-hmm. By the time he was at Spurs, he's a couple of years into Spurs, now he's very comfortable in English. But Pochettino apparently always knew English. He would communicate to the team at Southampton in English to the players. He just didn't feel comfortable talking to the media in English because you can say one wrong word and you say one wrong word to the team, you can correct it. If you say behind closed doors, if you say one wrong word with the media, they're all over you. So I think Tata Martino will probably be able to communicate with the guys in English. I don't think it's going to happen, but if he wants the job, I mean, he's obviously he shoots to the top of my list, and even ahead of Jesse Marsh. But my assumption is he doesn't want the job. That Atlanta is he's a project that he's interested in, and that, you know, he's done international management. He managed Argentina, got him to two finals. He managed Paraguay, got them to he got Paraguay to the round of eight, or the quarterfinals of the World Cup. I mean, his record speaks for itself, right? He got Barcelona within a point of winning La Liga, right? They drew the last day with Atleti. If they had won that game, they would have won the title. So, I don't think there's any question that he'd be the top guy. I just don't know that he wants the job. I mean, they're now requiring these coaches to live in Chicago. I think he probably likes living in Atlanta. But who knows? Maybe he's an option. I certainly think also there are some other Dutch possibilities that have been rumored connected to Ernie Stewart. Now, I don't take that very seriously. But, you know, if Louis van Gaal did want to manage the U.S., I think you have to think about it. Goose Heiding, I'm not sure I would want actually – But I know that name's been mentioned, and a couple other Dutch coaches. Look, I think that there's some possibilities here for the U.S. I don't think any of the names that have been thrown out are going to make matters worse. I do think, though, that some are better than others. And my objection to Vermees would be that I think he's very much wed to kind of a style, and also to a system where he's very aggressive personality-wise with his players, and he burns players out. He burns out assistant coaches. He burns out guys. He's a bit of a control freak. And the other thing I would worry about with Vermees is I think Kansas City has a tendency to fade late in the season every year. So I don't know if he works the guys too hard. Maybe there are other limitations, and it's not on him. But again, Berhalter, I could live with that. David Moyes, I could certainly live with. I like him, actually. That's interesting. I didn't take it very seriously. These Moyes rumors have been out there for a while. I didn't take it very seriously, but apparently he was there last night. So maybe he is talking to Ernie Stewart. Marsh is my top choice. But again, if I'm Marsh, I think twice about taking the job. Because if there is a possibility I'm going to be a head coach of a major European club in the next 4 years, you know, if he stays at Leipzig, let's say he stays as an assistant to Julia Nagelsmann, who's one of the top coaches in Europe right now, he's going to come over to RBL next year. If Marsh is his number two, and then let's say in 2020 he can get a job at, you know, a big club somewhere, even a job like Patrick Vieira got at Nice, although Nice is not playing very well, but under Vieira. But let's say he gets a job like that, Monaco, or, you know, a Premier League job, or Bundesliga job. I think Marsh might want to stay put and say, "Hey, I'll take the next cycle. I'll be the U.S. manager when we host the World Cup in 2026." So then you've got that, and then who else did we say? We talked about Martino. Is there another name? It's Moyes, Vermees, Berhalter, Marsh, Martino. Is there a guy we missed?
One guy I wanted to get the job, but obviously he's taken over Paraguay now, and that's Juan Carlos Osorio.
I mean, that was my first choice, but I think that we dragged our feet a little too much, and right, we weren't going to get him. So, yeah. I mean, yeah. He's the guy I wanted at the beginning of this process. You did too, but that's Look, I mean, there's a lot of anger out there among the fan base, and I agree with those fans that are angry that Osorio was never interviewed. But I guess our timeline, it is what it is. It's disappointing. It's upsetting. I mean, I think he was the obvious candidate, and not just for you and me, but for so many people. I mean, most people I talked to thought he was the best guy for the job, honestly, Daniel. Most people in our circle, you know, respected people that we talked to about soccer regularly, thought had Osorio one, and then they might have Berhalter two, they might have Marsh two, but I had Marsh two. But they didn't interview him for some reason. They weren't prepared to. He certainly was on the short list that Ernie Stewart had, but I mean, Osorio, I mean, why should Osorio turn down the Paraguay job? He can't sit around and wait for us. What if we don't hire him? So even though I think he was
I'm not upset about it. I'm not upset about it because, you know, I don't blame Osorio for taking the Paraguay job because, you know, U.S. soccer, look, this is a brand new thing when you have a general manager running the national team to, you know, help select the roster with the head coach. And, you know, you know, that's a brand new thing here, you know, for any, you know, FA in any parts of the world, because you don't need to have a general manager or a sporting director. You just have to have the head coach or the manager pick the players of who he wants to bring over. But, of course, you know, U.S. Soccer wanted to go through this route. And I don't think Ernie Stewart's a bad guy to be given this inaugural position. But you know what? Still, though, I think that U.S. Soccer...
I don't know. Look, they slowed down the process by hiring a GM. I don't know why you need a GM if it's not like a technical director, and why that GM is responsible for interviewing, and you hire the GM in August. So Juan Carlos Osorio leaves the Mexico job in July, and if you don't have a GM and your process is a little more streamlined, you can interview him, because when he quit the Mexico job right away, people were saying he wants the U.S. job, right? But, you know,
that's
no...
true. That's what I heard as well. He said he wanted it.
Yeah. So we didn't get a Sawyer. Maybe we get him in 2022. I don't know. But I guess we can lament it, but it's off the table. It's unfortunate. A lot of people are angry about it out there. I am too. But I guess we have to move on, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, we have to move on because, you know, he's not coming here now. But hopefully after this current cycle, I go after Juan Carlos Osorio if the manager is not, capable of whoever Ernie Stewart picks. Like, whoever the guy he picks, he's not capable. Move on from him, and let's just, you know, keep on going and try and bring over Osorio, who has done wonderful things for the Mexican national team, even though the fans, you know, love him, hate him, relationship, whether they want him fired or not. You know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, I mean, the Mexican fans, you know, they're very hostile to managers that come from outside. So that's a historic thing. That's been a historic grievance they've had. So, I mean, I think the other thing that I take away from last night, Daniel, in general, is that and this is – look, I think we can have a longer, more nuanced conversation about this. Obviously, we're talking about potential coaches here. But I really think – the shape and level of discipline in terms of the shape is better under Dave Sarokin than it was at any time under Jurgen Klinsmann, than it was the last 6 to 9 months under Bob Bradley, and than it was the year under Bruce Arena. So I know Sarokin's not going to get the job, but I have to
No, of course
say,
not. Nor should he.
Well, no. See, here, I mean, this is what I'm about to say. Nor should he, based on being Bruce Arena's assistant. But what I've seen from the tactical discipline from the United States under Sarokin is that it has been much better than it was under the end of Bradley. It was very good under Bradley until the last 9 months. It all kind of came apart and really got undone in that Gold Cup. Even though we got to the final in 2011, we were, you know, really looking kind of frayed in that. The shape was never good under Jurgen Klinsmann. Guys were bunching up all over the place, and I think had we not had Beckerman and Jones in the midfield, we would have had a lot more problems. Now, credit to Klinsmann. He selected Jones. He selected Beckerman. Both guys got a lot of stick from fans. Both guys were – I mean, those were our two best players in the World Cup in 2014, and I think for much of the cycle they were our best players. But and then under Arena. But what I'm trying to say is that I think whatever Sarokin is doing on the training ground with these younger players, he's getting through to them in terms of, hey, don't just go chasing loose balls. Hey, don't get drawn out of position. And we saw Miazga happen once yesterday, but don't get drawn out of position the way we were seeing regularly with this team under Arena and under Klinsmann. So I don't know what Sarokin's future is, because he is obviously a lifetime kind of MLS and college and now a national team coach. Is he a guy that can coach the U23 team or the U20 team? Is he a guy that stays on the staff as an assistant? I don't know, but I like what I'm seeing from him, and I did like him when he coached Chicago now many moons ago. It just didn't end well there. And they had to bring Juan Carlos Osorio in, actually. The aforementioned Osorio to kind of clean up the mess that at the end of the Sarakin era, but it was good at the beginning.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really want to put a word in there for Dave Sarakin. Obviously, he's not going to be the full-time coach, but I think he's done a credible job, and I think that it would be smart to keep him around in some capacity. You know, unless he wants to go back to MLS and manage an MLS again. I don't know that he wants to do that. I mean, I know in L.A., towards the end, he did a lot of the management. Bruce was – I don't want to say Bruce was checked out, but Bruce was – you know, Bruce trusts Sarakin and defers to him a lot.
Right.
But, you know, and then there's also – I have to put this in the mixer. You know, I'm reading Bruce Arena's book right now, Daniel, and Bruce Arena is very critical of Major League Soccer. So I – which Jurgen Klinsmann was also. I don't know if U.S. Soccer wants a manager who's going to be less critical of MLS or a manager that's going to continue to just kind of to beat the drum that Klinsmann and Arena are talking about. I mean, you know, essentially Bruce Arena in his book, very, very first page, he's talking about how MLS is being run as a business and not as a, you know, they've done great, some very good things, but they're putting – financial considerations ahead of soccer. And, you know, that's essentially the theme of a lot of what he's writing. So, which is stuff that you and I always talk about, but this is the question. Now, having gone through two managers in a row that have said that openly, and quite frankly, Bob Bradley probably believes it too, and just hasn't said it. Do they want to get a manager who's going to be more deferential to MLS than that? That's a big question. I hope not. But maybe they're going to say, hey, you need to, you know, we're going to hire you and you can't say anything bad about our domestic league. Now, Arena didn't say this stuff while he was manager, although he used to take pot shots at MLS when he coached in the league at the Galaxy, you know, made comments about the level of the league or some of the players or the rules and things like that. And I think a lot of people who don't know the history of Major League Soccer don't know that we have Bruce Arena to thank for the fact that MLS looks like a proper football league and doesn't look like some bastardized version of the sport. I mean, Bruce Arena was the guy who pushed back hard against all the efforts from the Lamar Hunts of the world, the Robert Krafts of the world to kind of Americanize the game. You know, because Arena said, our guys won't be able to compete internationally if you do this to us. You know, you got to change the clock rules. You got to run the clock properly. You got to have the offside rule the same as it is everywhere else. You know, the goal has to be the same size as everywhere else. So Bruce Arena, we owe him a lot. But he's shooting his mouth off now about MLS. He's shooting his mouth off about MLS. And I agree with him. But my point is, I think U.S. Soccer may not want another guy that's just going to, like Klinsmann and Arena, who are abrasive and are going to shoot their mouths off. I mean, Bradley was much more controlled in his approach, and maybe that's what they want. And if that's what they want, Peter Vermees is off the list. Jesse Marsh is probably off the list, and you're going to get Berhalter or Moyne, you know, guys who are less. Von Hall will definitely be off the list. Von Hall is really an abrasive guy, kind of like him, but in. So I think that's another thing we have to consider, that Bruce Arena had subsequent to being fired, after being fired, has written a book trashing Major League Soccer, or not necessarily trashing Major League Soccer, but making some very effective critiques of Major League Soccer and of the U.S. Soccer Federation. And I don't know if they want another manager like that.
Well, that's the one thing, you know, what does the U.S. Soccer Federation want? Do they want to put on their big boy pants and try to win a World Cup? Or you're just happy just to qualify and, you know, throw your hands up in the air and pray to God that you get a run going and then you can get to that final. But, I definitely will see what happens there. But I want to talk about, you know, McKennie, I thought, put himself in great position on a couple of those attacking runs. Unfortunately, he just couldn't keep the ball straight towards the net to get something substance into the back of the net. But like we've already said, McKennie's one of those players that is definitely the future for the national team. As we already said about Tyler Adams, he's one of the future. I like how Zach Steffen has been a keeper, not just for Columbus, but for the national team. It's time for the future. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, Cardick. I understand why you feel maybe Michael Bradley should be called into one of these friendlies, but the truth of the matter is this. I think it's time to see how these kids can perform. And I think so far, the one good thing about facing Brazil, they did not lose their cool. They did not lose their composure. Because you know as well as I do, when you're being beaten 2 to 3 steps ahead of yourself, meaning Brazil was always 2 to 3 steps ahead of the U.S., whether it's in passing, playing defense, getting numbers against whoever's carrying the ball, holding the ball, dribbling the ball up the field. They could have just easily,
yeah.
you know, really, really lost their control and lost their composure and start, you know, slide tackling hard, red cards coming, yellow cards coming, whatever it is. I am extremely happy that these kids did not intentionally lose their cool and they did not lose their composure. They kept their head to the ground, put their nose to the grinder. They kept on trying to find that way to break through the defense and try and break on the scoreboard. That's what I liked about last night the most.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on that. And I think we're seeing a lot of composure and a lot of, like I said, they're not losing their shape. And I think that's the way that's really good work from Dave Sarokin on the training ground. And we've got a group of players that understands that they have an awesome responsibility and that they have to really kind of step forward and take the torch that has been left to them and you know, the failure of this previous generation and not only improve the level of play, but improve the level of discipline and improve just in general the reputation of American soccer abroad.
Mm-hmm. Very true, Kardik. So I wanted your thoughts on the newest match that was announced this past Thursday, or this past Friday, I should say, before the USA took on Brazil. What do you think about USA-Peru over at East Hartford, Connecticut, at Rentschler Field, home for UConn college football? I mean, that's a great match. Peru just recently got to the World Cup in Russia this past summer. To me, Peru seems to be an up-and-coming power that can add on to South American soccer.
Yeah, I think it's really, really quite good. If you ask me, that they're getting a game in Hartford. I mean, I'm pretty excited about that. I think this is going to be a great test. There's going to be one, maybe two professional teams in Hartford real soon. So, obviously, a USL D3 team and potentially a team from another league, whether it's NISA or NPSL Pro. I think you've got a great base for the women's game there. We've seen the women's national team draw very well. So, I'm pretty excited about that match. And I think you get Colombia, you get Peru in that international break, two teams that qualify for the World Cup, two high-level size. I mean, Peru is an exciting team to watch, as I think everybody kind of fell in love with them in the World Cup. They were kind of naive. That's what happens when you qualify for the first time in 36 years. But they were fun. And then, obviously, in November, we go to Wembley. We take on England. I'm not quite sure. I'm not sure if I'm going to go over there for that match. I went the last time we played at Wembley. I go to London often. I was in London 2 weeks ago. So I might go to that match, and then we go to not sure where we're going to go, whether it's going to be in Rome or whether it's going to be in Milan or Turin, the game, the match against Italy. Might be Bologna, too, I understand. Might be one of those four places. The Italians coming off non-qualification. They struggled yesterday. They were lucky to get a draw against Poland in the Nations League. But those are big tests. So we got six matches really to kind of open things up before we get to the nitty-gritty of the Gold Cup and determining Gold Cup squads and whether or not you know, we're ready to go for the Gold Cup this next summer. And I think signs are fairly positive.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a big game once again on Tuesday at Nissan Stadium in Nashville, Tennessee. United States and Mexico, the border war, it's always going to be fun to see what's going to happen there. But, Kardik, thank you again for coming on tonight, and definitely have you on Tuesday for a post-match between the United States and Mexico. Thank you once again, and I'm going to give you a call as soon as the show is over. And I guess that's it for Carter Krishnire. Well, I want to thank him for coming on tonight for World Soccer Talk, Carter Krishnire. And I also want to thank you guys for listening tonight. Don't forget to join us this Tuesday night, USA-Mexico postgame show, right afterwards. For Carter Krishnire, I'm Daniel Feuerstein. This has been the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. Thank you for listening tonight. As always, please enjoy your football. Talk to you on Tuesday night. Bye-bye for now.